listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This past October 20th marked 7 years since the murder of former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi by U.S.-backed terrorists in Libya. Today we take a look at the situation in Libya, beginning with a case pending before the International Criminal Court against the son of Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. This is Fatou Bensouda, a prosecutor for the ICC, at this past Monday's Security Council meeting on Libya.
Mr. President, Your Excellencies, as this council is aware, in June of 2011, the pretrial chamber of the court issued a warrant of arrest against Mr. Gaddafi for the crimes against humanity of murder and persecution. This warrant of arrest was issued in relation to Mr. Gaddafi's contribution as de facto prime minister of Libya to a common plan to deter and quell, by any means, the demonstrations against the rule of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. On the 5th of June, earlier this year, Mr. Gaddafi filed an admissibility challenge, submitting that his case is inadmissible before the ICC. Significantly, in his challenge, Mr. Gaddafi states that on or around the 12th of April 2016, he was released from custody of the Abu Bakr al-Sadiq battalion in Zintan, pursuant to an amnesty law. Mr. Gaddafi also argues that as a consequence of the domestic proceedings conducted against him in Libya, he cannot be tried at the ICC. For the reasons set out in my written response to this admissibility challenge, which was filed on the 28th of September 2018, I argued that Mr. Gaddafi's case remains admissible before the court. My 16th report, which is transmitted to the Council 2 weeks ago, briefly outlines my submissions. My office maintains that Mr. Gaddafi must be arrested and surrendered to the court. This admissibility challenge is currently sub judice, and the pretrial chamber will render a decision in due course. I will therefore not delve any deeper into the factual and legal arguments in relation to this specific matter. Mr. President, Your Excellencies, turning to our ongoing investigations, my office continues to make considerable progress in the Libya situation. We continue to monitor criminal conduct carried out by members of armed groups in Libya whose alleged criminal acts could fall within the jurisdiction of the court. Armed groups use violence to exert control over state institutions, commit serious human rights violations and abuse, and exploit detainees in unregulated prisons and places of detention throughout the country. These armed groups represent a major threat to long-term peace and stability in Libya. We do not confine our investigations to any one group. We look at alleged Rome Statute crimes committed by actors across the territory of Libya. More information regarding the nature of these investigations cannot be divulged at present due to the confidential nature of investigations. Based on the progress made, my office hopes to be in a position to apply for new arrest warrants in connection with the Libya situation. I also remain focused on the alleged Rome Statute crimes committed against migrants transiting through Libya. The journeys these people embark upon can quickly turn into true nightmare scenarios where they become victims of the darkest side of human nature, where they are preyed upon mercilessly and their vulnerabilities exploited with no regard for decency or the rule of law. My office continues to receive evidence of serious crimes committed against migrants in Libya. These alleged crimes include killings, sexual violence, torture, and enslavement. In line with my June 2014 policy paper on sexual and gender-based crimes, my office integrates a gender perspective and analysis into these and all other investigations. My office recognizes that to effectively respond to these serious crimes, not only must they be addressed in Libya, but the criminal networks that facilitate such activities operating outside of Libya must also face justice. A multi-layered and multi-party strategy is therefore required to tackle the web of crimes that thrive in the context of the migration through Libya. To this end, my office continues to work collaboratively with various states, including Libya, as well as international law enforcement organizations. Information on crimes committed against migrants in Libya and on the business model used to perpetrate these horrific crimes is gathered, it is shared, and analyzed. We engage in this coordinated effort in the spirit of complementarity and in line with Goal 9 of my office's strategic plan. Pursuant to this cooperation model, efforts are being made to identify which entities are best placed to investigate or prosecute alleged crimes and determine what further support other partners can provide. The aim is to close the impunity gap at national, transnational, and international levels, and to hold accountable all those who commit these alleged crimes. I am pleased to inform you that this cooperation strategy is proving effective. My office also continues to benefit from and is grateful for the excellent cooperation it receives from the United Nations Support Mission in Libya and the Libyan Prosecutor General's Office. Mr. President, Your Excellencies, as you are aware, within the Rome Statute system of international criminal justice, the arrest and surrender of ICC suspects remain one of the most challenging issues for my office and the ICC as a whole. There can be no justice for the victims, and the aims of prevention and deterrence are hindered unless suspects are arrested and transferred to the court to stand trial. Contrary to urging the members of this council, and despite concerted efforts by my office and the registry of the court, Not one suspect in the Libya situation has been surrendered to the ICC. Mr. Gaddafi is at large, and despite his self-claimed release from custody over 2 years ago, he has shown no intention to surrender himself to the court or to the competent authorities in Libya. In relation to Mr. Al-Tuhami Mohamed Khalid, former head of the Libyan Internal Security Agency, this council will recall that in April of 2017, upon my request, the pretrial chamber made public a warrant originally issued under seal in April of 2013. While under seal, the warrant remained unexecuted for more than 4 years, despite diligent efforts by the registry and my office. I hope that unsealing the warrant of arrest could facilitate Mr. Al-Tuhami's arrest and surrender to the court. It is deeply regrettable that Mr. Al-Tuhami remains at large. Concerning the case of Mr. Mahmoud Mustafa Busaif Al-Wefali, a commander in the Al-Saika Brigade operating in and around Benghazi, this council will recall that on the 15th of August, 2017, a pretrial chamber of the court issued an arrest warrant against him, having found reasonable grounds to believe that he is criminally responsible for 7 execution incidents resulting in the murder of 33 individuals. Mr. Al-Wefali is yet another ICC suspect, not yet arrested and surrendered to the court. Furthermore, despite repeated claims by the Libyan National Army that Mr. Al-Wefali has been arrested and was being investigated, he is alleged to have murdered an additional 10 people earlier this year on the 24th of January in Benghazi. I reacted by filing a second application under seal for the arrest of Mr. Al-Wefali in connection with this alleged execution. On the 4th of July, the pretrial chamber issued a second public warrant of arrest for Mr. Al-Wefali for the alleged war crimes of murder. Mr. Al-Wefali is alleged to have committed war crimes. He must be apprehended and surrendered to the court to answer these serious charges. The court's legal proceedings will afford him, as for every ICC suspect, all due process rights guaranteed under the Rome Statute.
Also on Monday, the Security Council considered the situation that currently exists in Libya in the aftermath of the U.S.-led invasion of that country 7 years ago. This was China's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ma Zhaozhou, who's presiding this month over the Security Council, opening Monday's session.
The 8,389th meeting of the Security Council is called to order. The provisional agenda for this meeting is the situation in Libya. The agenda is adopted. In accordance with Rule 37 of the Council's Provisional Rules of Procedure, I invite the representative of Libya to participate in this meeting. It is so decided. The Security Council will now begin its consideration of Item 2 of the agenda. Members of the Council have before them document S/2018/985, the text of a draft resolution submitted by the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. The Council is ready to proceed to the vote on the draft resolution before it. I shall put the draft resolution to the vote now. The result of the voting is as follows. 13 votes in favour. 0 votes against. 2 abstentions. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2441-2018. I now give the floor to those members of the Council who wish to make statements after the vote. I give the floor to the representative of the United Kingdom.
Thank you, Mr. President. The United Kingdom welcomes the Security Council's agreement to renew the Libya sanctions regime. In particular, we welcome the fact that the Council has taken an important step by expanding the designation criteria to include gender-based violence. This sends a powerful signal that the international community will not tolerate such crimes. Sanctions remain an important tool for this Council in our work to support the government of national accord and to stabilise Libya. However, they can only be one part of the solution, which requires full political reconciliation. We reiterate our support to the Presidency Council and the government of national accord, headed by Prime Minister Sarraj, as the legitimate executive authorities under the Libyan political agreement. The Council needs to be ready to take swift action against spoilers who continue to obstruct the peace, security and stability in Libya. We welcome the tireless efforts of Special Representative Hassan Salameh and UNSMIL to reach an inclusive political settlement within the framework of the Libya political agreement, and we look forward to the SRSG's briefing to this Council on Wednesday. Thank you.
I thank the representative of the United Kingdom. I now give floor to the representative of Sweden.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, we welcome the adoption of this resolution reaffirming the Council's sanctions measures against Libya, and we would like to thank the United Kingdom for the transparent and inclusive negotiation process. Sweden, together with the Netherlands, and with the strong support of partners, is particularly pleased to have introduced the act of planning, directing or committing sexual and gender-based violence as a separate and distinct criterion for listing under the sanctions. Unfortunately, this is particularly relevant in the Libya context. As reported by the Secretary General, the SRSG on sexual violence in conflict and the 1970 Committee Panel of Experts, among others, conflict-related sexual violence, as well as sexual violence in detention centres, is an acute problem in Libya. It is our sincere hope that the highlighting of this problem can make a decisive change, compel compliance, and trigger accountability on the ground in Libya. On a horizontal level, we hope that the Council will continue to expand its sanctions listing criteria in other sanctions regimes when relevant, and counter the myth that sexual violence is an inevitable part of conflict. We furthermore welcome the Council's recognition of the need for sexual and gender-based violence expertise among the panel of experts, which will further give the Committee and the Council the understanding it needs to address this serious problem. Together with the UN support mission, the referral of the situation in Libya to the ICC and the measures to prevent migrant smuggling through Libya, the sanctions play an integral part in the Security Council's broader measures to support Libya in building long-term peace and stability. The Libya Sanctions Committee recently finished its first ever mission to the country, and the committee, through its Swedish chair, will provide its first impressions from that trip later this week. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the representative of Sweden. I shall now give the floor to the representative of Russia.
Thank you, Mr. President. We were unable to support the draft resolution that has been drafted by the United Kingdom. Our principled and duly justified remarks were not taken into account. The sponsors incorporated a provision in the resolution, a provision which establishes sexual and gender-based violence as a standalone criterion for the imposition of sanctions. And yet such action fully aligns with relevant criteria for listings criteria. The presence of precedents in Central African and South Sudanese sanctions committees does not imply that this practice needs to automatically apply to all country-specific country situations. Each situation is unique. The gender component is unjustifiably emerging in the work of the panel of experts of Security Council Committee 1970. This would distract those specialists from their direct obligations. The resolution is adopted under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, pursuant to which the Security Council identifies the presence of threats to international peace and security and introduces resolutions for the, on the measures being adopted to be adopted. This constitutes the main prerogative of the Security Council. The issue of sexual violence is considered at specialized platforms, for example, at the UN Human Rights Council or the UN Commission on the Status of Women. It is important to adhere to the relevant division of labor. Otherwise, instead of conflict resolution, the Security Council will have to track down violators and those perpetrating violence and to reason with domestic tyrants. Sexual and gender-based violence is among the components of a general crime in any specific country. For example, open-source data refers to the fact that in Sweden there has been a sustained growth in instances of sexual violence. And in the Netherlands, the indicator for violence against women is among the highest in the European Union. The struggle against such crimes, above all, is within the remit of national governments. Measures through the international community need to be subsidiary in nature, auxiliary in nature. We are under the impression that the countries who are pushing through this issue into the Security Council's agenda are attempting to gain a domestic political capital through the imposition of sanctions regimes against other states. Nobody considered whether there will be imposition of Security Council sanctions against specific individuals for sexual violence in Libya, whether this will have an impact in terms of preventing such crimes in that country. Such an approach is populism distilled to its purest form. The facts of such crimes perpetrated against migrants in Libya only confirm our premise that the most effective means of combating this scourge is eradicating the relevant criminal networks. Everything, including the information from the panel of experts, points to the fact that the footsteps lead to countries of destination of migrants, above all, Europe. However, we have not seen a desire of the European countries to impose Security Council sanctions against their own criminal authorities. Sir, just recently, when there was an extension of the mandate of the UN mission for the conduct of a referendum in Western Sahara, we referred to abuse by penholders of specific issues on the Security Council agenda. Today's case also attests to destructive working methods of the sponsors of the draft as they are not striving to have a consensus-based document be adopted. The penholdership mechanism is in need of major changes. Thank you for your attention.
I thank the representative of Russia. I shall now invite, give the floor to the representative of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. President. Today's vote to renew the mandate authorizing UN Security Council sanctions on illicit petroleum exports from Libya and asset freezes and travel bans on Libyan political spoilers should have been unanimous. It should be sending a clear message to the Libyan people that we are united behind you and that we on the Security Council will hold Libyan spoilers to account for their actions. The Security Council unanimously agreed to designate 6 migrant smugglers earlier this year for their abuses in Libya, which marked the very first time that we've ever used sanctions to respond to migrant trafficking. These criminal gangs cannot operate with impunity, and we remain deeply concerned about the welfare of the migrants they seek to exploit. We also unanimously agreed in September to designate Libyan militia leader Ibrahim Jadran for attacking Libya's oil facilities earlier this summer. This should be a warning to others who may try to seize Libya's resources for themselves, and this mandate clearly authorizes the Security Council to act in the future. One key factor that has not changed in Libya is the potential of the Libyan people and their desire to create a better country for themselves. The Security Council must continue to do its part. Thank you.
I thank the representative of the United States. I shall now give the floor to the representative of the Netherlands.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. And as this is our first meeting here in the open, please allow me to honor your presidency in trying to say this in Chinese.
Thank you, Mr. President.
First of all, let me take this opportunity to thank the United Kingdom for their diligent efforts in coordinating the drafting of this resolution. In our opinion, the Libya sanctions regime is a crucial element of this Council's efforts to support peace and stability in Libya. We welcome that this resolution extends this regime, including the mandate of the panel of experts, with another 15 months. We welcome in particular the addition of a new sanction criterion for sexual and gender-based violence, a proposal by Sweden and by us. Sexual and gender-based violence, particularly against migrants, constitutes an increasingly worrying problem in Libya, and it requires a strong response. The issue of sexual violence in Libya is directly connected to the issues of peace and security in Libya we are discussing here today. The addition of this designation criterion is an important step towards addressing this issue. The need for this was also underlined by many during the ARIA meeting on this issue on the 22nd of October, not only in regard to Libya, but across the Council's sanctions regimes and beyond. Mr. President, this year the committee put sanctions in place against 7 specific individuals. 6 of them concerned the first ever sanctions against human traffickers. These sanctions were proposed by the Kingdom of the Netherlands and partners in and outside this Council. Implementation of these and all sanctions is key. We therefore draw the attention of all Member States to the Council's call in this resolution to implement the travel ban and the asset freeze measures against these individuals and to report to the Committee on steps they have taken. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
I thank the representative of the Netherlands. I shall now give the floor to France.
Mr. President, at the outset, on behalf of France, I should like to extend to the Chinese Presidency of the Security Council to extend our warmest wishes for success during this month of November. France supported the renewal of the sanctions regime for a 15-month period. We welcome the adoption of Resolution 2441. It is of critical importance that we safeguard the constructive momentum within the Council on this issue, which should enable us to envisage positive steps to come and to help to achieve overall stability within Libya. And this within a context that we have observed in recent months, that of tremendous instability and fragility in Tripoli. This renewal text is essentially technical. Nonetheless, it provides some additions which are most welcome insofar as it helps to reinforce the sanctions regime. I specifically refer to the introduction of sexual and gender-based violence as a criterion for designation for sanctions. This, in the Libyan context, is an important step forward, due implementation of which is important to be achieved. This maintains the mechanisms in force regarding illicit imports of all oil-related products and reaffirms that Libya's oil resources need to remain under the exclusive sole control of the National Government of National Accord and the National Tripoli-based Oil Corporation for the benefit of all Libyan people. The resolution also helps to safeguard the arms embargo mechanism, which too is critical. In the light of persistent instability, building a national unified security architecture under the authority of a civilian is an uppermost priority. Lastly, the text reaffirms Council support for the Government of National Accord, as well as the urgent need to arrive at a political solution. It is critical to persevere in our initiatives on two pillars. On the one hand, combating all of those who jeopardize the tenuous political balances, those who exploit the situation to exploit Libyan resources. This needs to remain a priority for us. And on the other hand, a full support for UNMIL's for the mission's efforts and those of the Special Representative to advance the democratic transition within Libya. Libyan stakeholders need to work together with the Special Representative, Hassan Salameh, whose initiatives we fully support without further extending the deadlines. Respect for the commitments undertaken in Paris is of critical importance to break the status quo, which only makes instability all the more persistent. It is more important than ever before for the Council to remain united and mobilized around these shared goals, and you may count upon the commitment of France to achieve this. Thank you.
I thank the representative of France for his statement. Now I give the floor to the representative of Equatorial Guinea.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. The Republic of Equatorial Guinea is normally against sanctions when these don't have a clearly defined goal to improve or solve a situation in the country or region affected. In the case at hand, bearing in mind the atrocious effects of crime that exists not only in Libya, but also the effect it's having in Western Africa and Central Africa, we believe that these sanctions could help to slow down these effects. And also, we tend to forget the fact that it is women who most suffer in these situations, the kind of situation that exists in Libya at the moment. So human trafficking and sexual exploitation and abuse of immigrants, the illegal arms traffic, and the illicit trade of crude oil on the black market. And all of this simply leads to the ongoing suffering of the Libyan people. With the renewal of the sanctions text that we have just adopted, we believe and we hope that it will contribute, as I said previously, to pacifying the situation in this brotherly country of North Africa, Libya. Thank you.
I thank the representative of Equatorial Guinea for his statement. There are no other names inscribed on the list of speakers. The meeting is adjourned.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Up next, a post-election wrap-up. First, a Wednesday afternoon press conference with President Trump, followed by a response from the apparent speaker-to-be, Nancy Pelosi.
It was a big day yesterday, an incredible day. And last night, the Republican Party defied history to expand our Senate majority while significantly beating expectations in the House for the midterm and midterm year. We did this in spite of a very dramatic fundraising disadvantage driven by Democrats' wealthy donors and special interests and very hostile media coverage, to put it mildly. The media coverage set a new record and a new standard. We also had a staggering number of House retirements, so it's a little tough. These are seats that could have been held pretty easily, and we had newcomers going in, and a lot of them worked very hard, but it's very difficult when you have that many retirements. We held a large number of campaign rallies with large numbers of people going to everyone. To the best of my knowledge, we didn't have a vacant or an empty seat. I'm sure you would have reported it if you spotted one, including 30 rallies in the last 60 days. And we saw the candidates that I supported achieve tremendous success last night. As an example, of the 11 candidates we campaigned with during the last week, 9 won last night. This vigorous campaigning stopped the blue wave that they talked about. I don't know if there ever was such a thing, but could have been. If we didn't do the campaigning, probably there could have been. And the history really will see what a good job we did in the final couple of weeks in terms of getting some tremendous people over the finish line. They really are tremendous people, but many of them were not known. But they will be known. This election marks the largest Senate gains for a president's party in a first midterm election since at least President Kennedy's in 1962. There have been only four midterm elections since 1934 in which a president's party has gained even a single Senate seat. As of now, we picked up, it looks like three. Could be four, perhaps it could be two, but we picked up a lot. And most likely the number will be three. You people probably know that better than I do at this point because you've looked at the more recent numbers. 55 is the largest number of Republican senators in the last 100 years. In the last 80 years, a sitting president's party has only gained a cumulative total of eight Senate seats, averaging one per decade. So if we picked up two, three, or four, that's a big percentage of that number. So in the last 80 years, you think of that, only eight seats. In President Obama's first midterm election, he lost six Senate seats, including in the deep blue state of Massachusetts. Republicans captured at least four Senate seats held by Democrat incumbents. And these are tremendously talented, hardworking people that did this. Indiana, North Dakota, Florida, Missouri. We also won two open Senate seats in Tennessee. I want to congratulate our great champion who did such a great job in Tennessee, Marsha, and in Utah. And Arizona is looking very good, really very good. She's done a terrific job. That was a tough race, and she's done a fantastic job. In each of these open seats, Democrats recruited very strong candidates with substantial fundraising and media support. We were getting bombarded with money on the other side. In the House, Republicans dramatically outperformed historical precedents and overcame a historic number of retirements, the most House Republican retirements in 88 years, 43 House Republicans retired. Now, I will say this, that in many cases they were chairmen of committees, and they left because they weren't chairman, because the Republicans have a rule for 6 years. And what that does is wonderful in one way. It lets people come through the system and become chairman. In another way, it drives people out. Because when they're a chairman, they don't want to go and not be a chairman. You're the chairman of a committee, and you're a big deal, and all of a sudden, you're not doing that anymore. So they leave. We had a lot of them leave. It's, I guess you can flip a coin as to which system is better. The Democrats do the other. Some of their folks have been on those committees for a long time as chairman. In 2010, President Obama's first midterm, he lost 63 seats. By contrast, as of the most current count, looks like around 27 House seats or something, and we'll figure that out pretty soon. We also had a slew of historic wins in the governor's races. The governor's races were incredible against very well-funded, talented, and skilled Democrat candidates and people that worked very, very hard, respectfully, for those candidates, like Oprah Winfrey, who I like. I don't know if she likes me anymore, but that's okay. She used to. But she worked very hard in Georgia, very, very hard. And if you look at them, with four governor's races crucial to 2020 and the presidential race, Florida, Iowa, Ohio, and Georgia, the big ones. Florida, Iowa, Ohio, and Georgia. Can't get much more important than that. They were incredible. They were actually incredible campaigns, too. Incredible. As of right now, Republicans will control the majority of governorships across the country, including three great women who worked very hard. Governors of Alabama, South Dakota, and Iowa. They worked very, very hard. They're very talented. By expanding our Senate majority, the voters have also clearly rebuked the Senate Democrats for their handling of the Kavanaugh hearings. That was a factor, I think maybe a very big factor. The way that was handled, I think, was tremendous energy was given to the Republican Party by the way they treated then-Judge Kavanaugh, now Justice Kavanaugh, and expressed their support for confirming more great pro-Constitution judges. Candidates who embraced our message of low taxes, low regulations, low crime, strong borders, and great judges excelled last night. They excelled. They really, I mean, we have a list of people that were fantastic. And I'm just going to point them out. Mike Bost, Rodney Davis, Andy Barr was fantastic. I went to Kentucky. For the most part, I didn't campaign for the House, but I did actually make a special trip for Andy Barr because he was in a very tough race in Kentucky, and he won. That was a very tough race. The polls were all showing that he was down and down substantially, and he won. And that one I did do. Pete Stauber of Minnesota, great guy. He's new and ran a fantastic race. On the other hand, you had some that decided to, let's stay away. They did very poorly. I'm not sure that I should be happy or sad, but I feel just fine about it. Carlos Cubella, Mike Kaufman, too bad, Mike. Mia Love, I saw Mia Love. She'd call me all the time to help her with a hostage situation, being held hostage in Venezuela. But Mia Love gave me no love, and she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia. And Barbara Comstock was another one. I mean, I think she could have won that race, but she didn't want to have any embrace. For that, I don't blame her. But she lost, substantially lost. Peter Roskam didn't want the embrace. Eric Paulson didn't want the embrace. And in New Jersey, I think he could have done well, but didn't work out too good. Bob Eugen, I feel badly because I think that's something that could have been won. That's a race that could have been won. John Faso, those are some of the people that, you know, decided for their own reason not to embrace whether it's me or what we stand for, but what we stand for meant a lot to most people. And we've had tremendous support and tremendous support in the Republican Party among the biggest support in the history of the party. I've actually heard at 93%, it's a record, but I won't say that because who knows. But we've had tremendous support. America is booming like never before, doing fantastic. We have Larry Kudlow here, and he said the numbers are as good as he's ever seen numbers at any time for our country. But he's a young man, so he hasn't seen that many numbers. Where's Larry? You're a young man, right, Larry? And you haven't been doing this too long, but they're as good as you've ever seen. And we may have, if you have a question for Larry, we'll do that. But I want to send my warmest appreciation and regards to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We really worked very well together. We have been working very well together. We actually have a great relationship. People just don't understand that, which is fine. And also to perhaps, looks like, I would think, Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And I give her a lot of credit. She works very hard, and she's worked long and hard. I give her a great deal of credit for what she's done and what she's accomplished. Hopefully, we can all work together next year to continue delivering for the American people, including on economic growth, infrastructure, trade, lowering the cost of prescription drugs. These are some of the things that the Democrats do want to work on, and I really believe we'll be able to do that. I think we're going to have a lot lot of reason to do it. And I will say, just as a matter of business, I was with some very successful people last night. We were watching the returns. So if the Republicans won, and let's say we held on by two, or one, or three, it would have been very hard out of that many Republicans to ever even get support among Republicans, because there'll always be one or two or three people that, for good reason or for bad reason or for grandstanding, we have that too. You've seen that. You've seen that. Plenty of grandstanding. But for certain reasons, that many people, you're always going to have a couple that won't do it. So that puts us in a very bad position. In other words, had we kept, and this is no, I'm saying this for a very basic reason, it's common sense. It puts us in a very tough position. We win by one or two or three, and you'll have one or two or three or four or five even come over and say, you know, look, we're not going to go along with this. We want this, 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 and all of a sudden we wouldn't even be able to get it in many cases out of the Republicans' hands before we sent it on to the Senate. And now we have a much easier path because the Democrats will come to us with a plan for infrastructure, a plan for health care, a plan for whatever they are looking at, and we'll negotiate. And as you know, it's been very hard in the Senate because we need essentially 10 votes from Democrats, and we don't get those votes because the Democrats do really stick together well. I don't agree with them on a lot of policy, but I agree with them on sticking together. They stick together great. So now we go into the Senate. We don't have the 10 votes. And what happens? It doesn't get passed. Even if it gets out of the House, it doesn't get passed. So under the new concept of what we're doing, I say, come on, let me see what you have. They want to do things. You know, I keep hearing about investigations, fatigue. Like from the time, almost from the time I announced I was going to run, they've been giving us this investigation fatigue. It's been a long time. They got nothing, zero. You know why? Because there is nothing. But they can play that game, but we can play it better, because we have a thing called the United States Senate, and a lot of very questionable things were done between leaks of classified information and many other elements that should not have taken place. And all you're going to do is end up in back and forth and back and forth, and 2 years is going to go up, and we won't have done a thing. I really think, and I really respected what Nancy said last night about bipartisanship and getting together and uniting. She used the word uniting, and she used the bipartisanship statement, which is so important because that's what we should be doing. So we can look at us, they can look at us, and then we can look at them, and it'll go back and forth, and it'll probably be very good for me politically. I could see it being extremely good politically, because I think I'm better at that game than they are, actually. But we'll find out. I mean, you know, we'll find out. Or we can work together. You can't do them simultaneously, by the way, just in case somebody says, oh, you can do them both. No, you can't. Because if they're doing that, we're not doing the other, just so you understand. So we won't be doing that. But now what happens is we send it to the Senate, and we'll get 100% Democrat support, and we'll get some Republican support. And if it's good, I really believe we have Republicans that will help with the approval process, and they will really help with the approval process. So it really could be a beautiful bipartisan type of situation. If we won by one or two or three or four or five, that wouldn't happen. And the closer it is, the worse it is. This way, they'll come to me, we'll negotiate, maybe we'll make a deal, maybe we won't. That's possible. But we have a lot of things in common on infrastructure. We want to do something on health care. They want to do something on health care. There are a lot of great things that we can do together. And now we'll send it up, and we will really get, we'll get the Democrats, and we'll get the Republicans or some of the Republicans. And I'll make sure that we send something up that the Republicans can support. And they're going to want to make sure they send something up that the Democrats can support. So our great country is booming like never before, and we're thriving on every single level, both in terms of economic and military strength, in terms of development, in terms of GDP, we're doing unbelievably. I will tell you our trade deals are coming along fantastically. The USMCA and South Korea is finished. USMCA has gotten rave reviews. We're not going to lose companies anymore to other countries. They're not going to do that because they have a tremendous economic incentive. Meaning it's prohibitive for them to do that. So it's not going to be like NAFTA, which is one of the worst deals I've ever seen, although we've made some other pretty bad ones too. Now is the time for members of both parties to join together, put partisanship aside, and keep the American economic miracle going strong. It is a miracle. We're doing so well. And I've said it at a lot of rallies. Some of you have probably heard it so much you don't want to hear it again. But when people come to my office, presidents, prime ministers, they all congratulate me almost the first thing on what we've done economically, because it is really amazing. And our steel industry is back. Our aluminum industry is starting to do really well. These are industries that were dead. Our miners are working again. We must all work together to protect our military. We have to do that. To support our law enforcement, secure our borders, and advance really great policy, including environmental policy. We want crystal clean water. We want beautiful, perfect air. Air and water has to be perfect. At the same time, we don't want to put ourselves at a disadvantage to other countries who are very competitive with us and who don't abide by the rules at all. We don't want to hurt our jobs. We don't want to hurt our factories. We don't want companies leaving. We want to be totally competitive, and we are. And right now we have just about the cleanest air, the cleanest water we've ever had, and it's always going to be that way. We insist on it. So environmental is very important to me. And with that, I'll take a few questions if you'd like.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.